back together again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, December 3rd, 2025 on Connecticut Today, where I open the show wondering if it would be wise for a cable TV news host and policy pundit to enter the race for the 2026 Republican gubernatorial nomination. Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Haar weighed in on that possible candidacy, as well as his conversations recently with Afghans in the state. And at Landmark Legal Foundation, VP of Legal Affairs Mike O'Neill, on a big U.S. Supreme Court case coming up in just a few days.
Well, I'm glad that at least somebody else is saying it, and we'll talk to that somebody else later on in the 5 o'clock hour. Our buddy Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, but Dan has a story today, and we'll definitely check in with him later on this. Does the name Betsy McCoy Ross or Betsy McCoy ring a bell? Former lieutenant governor of New York, conservative commentator. She writes a piece in the New York Post every so often. She's a good writer. I think I chatted with her a few years ago. I'm not sure. A longtime and current resident of Connecticut. So she's got the state's good fortunes and intentions as a chief preference of hers, and she's considering a run for governor on the Republican side, of course. Now, again, if you are a viewer of cable news, if you tend to read the New York Post, if you are a consumer of, shall we say, right-leaning media, you know the name Betsy McCoy. She was the lieutenant governor, I think, under George Pataki many, many years ago. She's a Connecticut resident now. She's not a newbie. She's 77. And apparently now, and I texted and asked some people, is this Betsy McCoy thing serious? And a few people have told me, yes, it is. Now, what did I mention the other day? I mentioned, and again, this is nothing to do with Betsy McCoy. This is nothing to do particularly with Ryan Fazio. This has nothing to do particularly with Aaron Stewart. We'll have all of them here on the show several times over the next year to give you the words right from their own mouths about how they feel about Connecticut, what they would do. You've already heard from them numerous times. We had Ryan on yesterday. He's been on the show before. Aaron Stewart's been on the show before, so we're not going to shy away from this. But if you remember a couple of days ago, I mentioned, I think it was over the weekend or during the time I was off last week and into this past weekend, I continue to wonder what, not so much the Republican Party here is under the tutelage of Ben Proto, who I will admit is an acquaintance of mine, a friend of mine. I've known Ben ever since I worked for a couple of campaigns about 15 years ago. In fact, 15 years ago this cycle. So I've gotten to know Ben over the years, but I'm more fascinated with the Republican voter in this state. And apparently now Betsy McCoy would have to fund here and self-fund, because, again, none of these people, whether it's Betsy McCoy, whether it's Ryan Fazio, whether it's Aaron Stewart, they'd simply, and this is nothing against them, they simply don't have the kind of money that Ned Lamont has. A very successful businessman. His family comes from money. He grew up amongst and around money. And I don't besmirch anybody or belittle anybody for doing that. If you are, fortunate enough to have that sort of upbringing, then good for you. God bless you. Vaya con Dios. But I find it hard to believe. And this is nothing against Betsy McCoy. This is nothing against people who support her. But I find it hard to believe. Now, you may disagree with me on this. You can, if you'd like, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Of course, that is talk or text. I find it difficult to believe that another Republican candidate is needed right now. And the reason being this, Let me drop back to what I opened the monologue here. Dan Harm mentions it in his piece. In 9 of the last 10 elections for the U.S. Senate or governor, 9 of the last 10, and this is something I mention all the time, because you people in the Republican Party have to get it through your heads here. In 9 of the last 10 elections for U.S. Senate or governor, Republicans have nominated a person who has never held elected office. Now, Betsy McCoy has at one point. She was the lieutenant governor at one point. Most of the nominees, Tom Foley, Linda McMahon, Bob Stefanowski, Leora Levy, were rich self-funders with little or no experience in state politics. Not coincidentally, the Connecticut Republican Party last won a state ride or congressional election in 2006. So my point here is that, you know, for Betsy McCoy to be running as an outsider here, she has held prominent office. She's never won an election, as Dan puts it, in her own right. So, yes, not besmirching her that she was the lieutenant governor of a state of the union. That is a high, you know, there are only a handful of people who have ever done that. But would the Republican voters in any appreciative number, and frankly, I don't care who you vote for, I say this all the time, but would any Republican voters in any appreciative number say, meh, I'd rather, and again, this is nothing against her. Like I said, I talked to her a few years back, I believe, if I remember correctly. And I read a lot of her columns. I see her on cable sometimes. I'm like, yeah, it's interesting stuff. But isn't it time to look at things a little differently for the Republican Party in this state? I mean, she's never won an election, as Dan points out here in his piece, in her own right. Say what you will about Aaron Stewart. She won numerous elections. Say what you will about Ryan Fazio. He is an elected official. Why would the Republican Party in any sort of numbers gravitate to the same thinking on a candidate basis that hasn't worked? That hasn't worked in 9 of the last 10 elections. Why would the state Republican Party do that? It doesn't make any sense. Help me out here. Are folks that desperate for alternative candidates that it comes down to just voting for someone or anyone here as long as they can get the money, whether they were elected somewhere or not? Electoral experience, I think, matters here. And I'm not saying that Betsy McCoy couldn't make a capable, if not a successful, governor. None of us know that. None of us know how any politician would in any way be any grade of successful or unsuccessful until we give them the keys to the car and say, we'll see you in 2 years, or we'll see you in 4 years, or in case of the U.S. Senate, we'll see you in 6 years. A long time, 6 years. So I'm interested to see, especially from, shall we say, center-right or right-leaning voters, should Betsy McCoy get into the race here? Again, you have, albeit a successful in life woman in her late 70s. I think that's a factor you have to bring in here. Although with a successful media career. Do we go back, again, we meaning the Republican Party and those of us who tend to attack right a little bit here, do you go back again to the formula that didn't work? with Bob Stefanowski. That didn't work with Tom Foley. That didn't work with Leora Levy. That didn't work with Linda McMahon. You tell me. Question of the day here is we start off at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Very simple question of the day here. Are you happy with the current candidate field for Connecticut's 2026 governor's race? Do we need more candidates? And how do you feel about candidates that have never held elected office before? We're back with more. We begin right here on WICC. Are Republican voters in the state, let me say primary voters, because there are a lot of Republicans or Republican-leaning candidates that don't vote in the primary for whatever reason. That's not for me to question or to make a judgment on a person, on Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. Some people like to vote in primaries, some don't. Some people say, well, just give me the stinking nominee and I'll decide whether I vote for him, her, or it. But there's rumblings now, and we'll talk to Dan Hart coming up in the 5 o'clock hour about this. Betsy McCoy, you may remember the name. You may see her. She's on. Apparently, she's on Newsmax. I do read a number of her pieces she writes for the New York Post. She has spent a good part of her life in Connecticut, along with being a New York person and having served as the lieutenant governor to former Governor George Pataki back in the 90s. But she ran under him. In other words, she did not run herself. She has never, and I'm not saying this makes her good, bad, or otherwise, but she has never won an election outright herself. But yet, There's some thought now that she may enter the race as a Republican against Aaron Stewart and against Ryan Fazio and whomever may enter the race between now and, you know, whatever the cutoff would be, June, July, August, I don't know, next year. And again, siphon votes from somebody who might be more electable. And as Dan Hart points out here, in 9 of the last 10 elections for governor or the U.S. Senate, Republicans have nominated a person who has never held elected office. How has that worked out? Why would we want, we meaning the Republican Party, why do that again? I don't understand. With all due respect to Betsy McCoy, does she really think she can win? Being on Newsmax, I guess she thinks she can use her her name recognition, whatever, to her advantage. Maybe I don't know, but I just don't get this. I don't understand this. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Why has the Republican Party in this state gravitated so much toward people who've never won elections? What is it? And I'm not blaming the party hierarchy, because I'm glad they don't blame people, that they don't bar people from running. You know me, the more the merrier, but come on. And yet I see on social media, you've got a lot of quote-unquote Republican voters out there, and a lot of you know who you are, bombarding Aaron Stewart already, bombarding Ryan Fazio. Oh, they're not conservative enough. Give me a break. Do you want to cuddle your conservative dollar, or you want to win? Hey, what's the deal here? Bob in Weston's here. Bob, how are you? What's going on?
Hey, Paul.
Yes.
Paul, I'm more afraid of the unknown. Look what happened in New York City.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a guy like Bloomberg, you know, he's more of a centrist. Mm-hmm. And then it went downhill from there. My God, look what we have now. Mm-hmm. What has Governor Malloy done that's so bad? He keeps the Democrat Senate under control. I think he's a great guy. And I think we're just going to rattle the feathers of the Senate if we get, like you were saying, you know, all these people are not politicians. They're not tried and true.
Yep.
I think we better take another 4 years, put Malloy back in office.
You mean Lamont.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm
no, sorry. I
it's
do
so
the
nice
same thing.
Day. I'm daydreaming.
Yeah.
Forgive me.
All right.
Forgive me.
No, Bob, I do have to scoot. I get the point. No, you're right, Bob, and thank you. This is why, Bob, to your point, this is why Ned Lamont's got like 10 or 12% support from Republicans. Because believe me, they know. They know and they understand what I know and understand. For you people out there that don't like Ned Lamont, I get you, I understand. Please, once Ned Lamont has done serving this state, if it then goes to Susan Bisewitz or somebody like William Tong or somebody like that, Ned Lamont is going to look like Ronald Wilson Reagan. All right, let's see what's in the fertile mind of our friend Dan Harhurst, Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist, as we're back after the break. Dan, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon.
It is a busy, busy day. Before we get to the juicy political story of the day, which I got a bunch of calls on earlier, you are also looking, Dan, into the local aspect of what may happen to Afghan immigrants, Afghan migrants, Afghan refugees, depending upon the whim of the Trump White House. So what did you find out there?
Well, as is typical in these situations, we don't know, of course, and they don't know. It's similar to the situation where Ukrainians who came over in that program when the war started in 22 were having their 2-year humanitarian parole visas not renewed. Mm-hmm. And that's the analogy here is with this is a special program, and Trump has gone and targeted this special program. And as always is the case, he's not very specific about what he said, what he means when he says in broad terms, we're going to end all visa applications. I did speak with some members of the Afghan community in Connecticut, mm-hmm, who have friends. The ones I spoke to are citizens.
Okay.
The people who,
yep,
are not citizens are not really, they're, you know, understandably afraid to talk.
Sure.
The citizens that I spoke with said that the people who are not citizens, especially those who are still seeking asylum.
Yeah.
Remember, there are different gradations of security and of status. And the people who are most tenuous are those who are still seeking asylum and haven't been granted asylum. Mm. That was the case with the person who is a suspected shooter in the National Guard shooting. He just got asylum in May, and he had been here since 21. So the short answer is people are very afraid, and these are not people, you know, in the streets. One of them is a college professor.
Mm.
You know, they're engineers. They're here in the community.
Yeah, tough stuff. Dan, forgive me, I don't mean to pin you up against the wall here with numbers or locations. Is there a large Afghan community here in the state? I don't know that. Is there?
Yes. Yes, disproportionate.
Really?
It is. Yes, yes. For reasons I don't know, you know, why are there, you know, I don't, I guess people settle. If I have... The Afghan American Association of New Haven,
yeah,
is large and active, and
wow,
he told me they have 1,000 members.
Wow.
And that's just that association. Other people that I spoke with were not in that association for whatever reason. So, yes, it's disproportionately large.
Interesting.
It doesn't mean that they're rivaling, you know, it's not tens of thousands of people in Connecticut, but it's, you know, maybe a couple thousand.
No, oh, interesting. Dan Har here, Hearst Connecticut Media. All right, Betsy McCoy. A lot of people, you know, Dan, you and I have been following her for years, obviously, back to her days that you point out in your excellent piece that she ran with George Pataki, has never run and won anything on her own, currently on Newsmax. Dan, are we possibly looking at another push to pull a Leora Levy here or not? What do you think?
Well, not to cast any aspersions on Leora Levy, but Betsy McCoy has some of the outlandish sort of extreme, I would call, maybe not extreme views, but extreme mm-hmm statements.
Yeah.
But she's also a policy intellectual with a PhD from,
sure,
Columbia,
sure,
who's done a lot of thinking and writing. So she has that sort of that intriguing combination of the sort of MAGA, the MAGA brand of craziness, not to say crazy, with sort of that more buttoned down policy chops. So it's a little bit of both. I actually did not know that she had never won an election prior to this. I kind of assumed that when she became lieutenant governor, she had been maybe an assemblywoman or something like, or maybe a city council member, you know, something something. Pataki picked her as a policy person, and of course she made her name with the attack on Clinton Care, much later Obamacare, but that was after the after she served.
Yeah. Dan Haar, the guest, Hearst Connecticut Media. All right, Dan, there is a really interesting freedom of...
By the way, have you had her on?
No, but I plan to if she stays with this. Yeah, unless she cools the jets on this. I will.
She's a good guest. I recommend it. I heard her on one of your competitors' shows yesterday. She's a good guest.
Yeah, and believe me, the guy you heard her on, well, we've been friends for a long time. So yeah, I'm gonna check that out. There is a really interesting free. There is a there. Come on, leave Vinny alone. There is a reeling Dan Haar, interesting freedom of information case that I was reading, and I went, wow, look at this. Break that down for us, because people need to know about this.
At its fundamental core, this is the case by a person who has been challenging rulings by the banking department. So it's a very complicated case, but the owner of the former mortgage company has been seeking thousands of pages of evidence that he believes shows that the banking department did not have authority to do what it did. Right. So that's the underlying case. Much more important than the underlying case is that what you need to know is that he was seeking documents going back and forth between the banking department and the legislature. Those have always been deemed to be public. This new ruling by the Freedom of Information Commission upholds that and says these are public. Hand them over.
Yeah.
Attorney General William Tan says, no, they're not public because of this obscure constitutional provision that protects legislators from being sued and therefore says that what they say is, in his interpretation, private. Most notable in this is that three of the four caucus leaders, the two Republicans and the two Democrats, only Senator Martin Looney is saying, I support this. The rest of them are saying, wait a minute here. I mean to say that all this stuff that we're going back and forth is not public. And so that's it remains. It's going to obviously be sorted out in the courts.
Yeah.
Personally, I think it's a little bit too narrow a ruling to say that it's too broad a ruling to say that this exemption applies. I think the information should be public.
Yeah. Another one of my old dear friends, Marty Looney. And let's wrap up on this, Dan Haar. You're always a good state finances guy. You can interpret the numbers for us. Where do we stand right now on this December 3rd in the state of Connecticut?
Well, tomorrow, today is the eve of the annual fiscal accountability report, which to everyone else is a day that they don't notice on the calendar, but to people who watch the budget, this is the annual checkup for the budget in the state before any given legislative session. And the short answer is we're doing well, but not as well as we had been doing. And so the cries to spend more and cut more taxes are going to be fought back by the people who say, let's stay the course.
Interesting. All right, folks, check it out. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media, senior columnist and editor. And Dan, besides the budget numbers tomorrow, anything else you might be working on that we should watch out for in the next few days?
For me, I had the two columns this week, and I'm working. I probably will weigh in on that FOI case.
Interesting. All right, Dan, be good, buddy. Drive safely. We'll talk. Thanks, man.
Take care.
All right, Dan Haar there, Hearst Connecticut Media. All right, to one of our go-to guys. He's VP of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation, Mike O'Neill, to explain a couple of things to us, stuff that you should know, even though it's the U.S. Supreme Court, and it feels like it's 1,000 miles away. Mike, it's Paul. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, Mike, as always, taking the time. Mike, before we get to the case hand, which is a major case, how do we stand on the big case from a couple of weeks ago? Was it the tariff case? Are we just waiting on that now? Because the White House is saying, depending upon how that goes, that may or may not have something to do with rebate checks. So recap the tariff case for us.
Right. So this was, again, oral arguments were held a couple of weeks ago.
This is
the question about whether the president has the authority under this Emergency Economic Act to levy the tariffs that he's been levying. And the court, I think what we're talking about here with regards to rebate checks I think that's the White House posturing with a little bit of political pressure.
Sure.
But I don't think the Supreme Court's going to yield to that.
Yeah.
And it looked like, really just to briefly recap it, I think that the court, the takeaway was the court was fairly skeptical about the assertion of the president's power to levy these tariffs. I think there was a significant questions from justices that you normally consider to be technically in the president's court, particularly mm-hmm. Justice Gorsuch. He made a really important point about emergency powers. If you can recall, one of the questions that kind of telegraphed where his brain was, and again, this is Justice Gorsuch, so this is generally one of the justices that you count on for being on the president's side if we're going to do that. So he asked that question. He said, well, if this emergency power extends to these tariffs, doesn't that mean that a future president can declare a climate emergency and then levy a tariff on gas powered cars? So essentially take this massive role. So that kind of telegraphed where Justice Gorsuch was sitting with his was sitting in his position. You know, we can only derive so much from the oral arguments.
Yeah.
So it looks like that, you know, there were some questions from Justice Alito that were maybe carving out and recognizing there might be some alternative statutory authority. There might be. So you know, there was some significant skepticism from the court in this.
Wow.
I will say this, though, Paul, is that we know that Justice Roberts is a pragmatist. We know that he's aware of the not just the legal implications, but the practical implications of these decisions.
Yeah.
And we are talking about hundreds of billions of dollars here and a lot of horse outside the barn kind of issues. So there might be some sort of middling ground workaround that the court says proactively, not retrospectively, not it's a lot going on with this case. It's going to be I can tell you this. It's going to be a fairly fractured opinion, and it's going to be very complicated. So it's going to take a little bit of time to probably work out all the details on it, just because there's so many different issues survive around it.
Wow. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. Okay, now I got an email from you, Mike, regarding a really, really important case that you say could really have something to do with future presidential power.
Right.
The case is Trump v. Slaughter. Now, we're not talking about Sergeant Slaughter. We're talking about Trump v. Slaughter in what way? What is this?
Right. So this is a case that's going to consider the propriety and the constitutionality of a case that dates back almost 100 years called Humphrey's Executor. And in this case, this is from 1935 opinion. This is, again, right in the New Deal era we're talking about here, right in the mid-1930s. This is a case that the Supreme Court held that Congress could create these quasi-independent agencies, these alphabet soup agencies, and insulate the heads of those agencies from for-cause termination by the president.
Wow.
So, and that's been the law of the land for basically the past 90 years. Before that, the president retained all of executive authority over the branches of government. In other words, if you were the head of an agency, for example, the agencies to the extent they existed pre-1935, the president could terminate you if you weren't on board with his agenda. Well, now what would happen with this post Humphrey's Executor, Congress could enact a law establishing an agency like the Federal Trade Commission, and that's what the dispute back in the 1930s, and that's what the dispute today in Trump versus Slaughter, where the heads of those the commissioners who serve on the board of the Federal Trade Commission are insulated from the president being able to terminate them. So, a President Trump. Say President Biden appoints a commissioner to serve on the FTC. That commissioner is sitting there. President Trump comes in and says, wait a minute, you're not on board with my agenda. You're an executive agency. You're asserting executive power. And yet I can't kick you out and put in some of my guys.
Mm.
And so the question really becomes is where is the executive power vested in? Remember, Article 2 says all executive power is vested in the president. So amongst conservative lawyers, this Humphrey's Executor case, again from 1930s, has really been a kind of a thorn in our eye, right? We've always said a splinter in our eye. We've always said, wait a minute, this is extra constitutional. Congress can't assign executive power via statute because the Constitution vests executive power with the President of the United States. So this is an issue that's going to be argued tomorrow in front of the Supreme Court. There's going to be robust arguments on this. And it really is going to kind of affect how the president comports or comprises these quasi-independent agencies like the FTC or other agencies.
Interesting. And Mike, finally, you may have mentioned this at the outset, but you said 1935. So was this an outgrowth of the battle, the arm wrestling at the time between the Roosevelt administration and Congress in the New Deal as to what was legal and what was illegal? And was Roosevelt overstepping his authority? Were there roots there in the New Deal there?
Right. Well, essentially what they had done was that it was the propriety of the composition of the Federal Trade Commission.
Okay.
And again, Congress had said, we're going to have these we're going to appoint these, we're going to vest the power to the president to appoint them, but then he can't terminate them but for cause, and they can serve these staggered terms. So it really was part of that New Deal. Again, it was part of the bevy of legislation that was passed. It's really kind of here about whether Congress can circumvent the executive authority of the president. And here it comes. The argument back then, and the argument, the justification for Humphrey's executor, Paul, was that these individuals don't just function as executives. They don't assert executive power. They assert legislative and judicial power. And
sure.
So that's kind of their technical constitutional workaround. The bottom line is these are folks who are in there. They function as executives. They assert executive power. They need to be answered to the president. If the president has the authority to terminate their employment, that's his authority under the Constitution, and that's what we're going to look forward to tomorrow.
Excellent. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, as always, we thank you for your common sense explanations here. Mike, thank you. We'll chat down the road.
Talk to you soon, Paul. Have a great day.
Thank you. Mike O'Neill there, Senior VP of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation. So how about that?